Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much.
We are in the midst of the opening phases of Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. And so what we thought we would do today with our show is to sort of talk about less about the trial itself and more about the cast of characters involved with it, and to talk about this trial in conjunction with the two other Senate impeachment trials, that of Andrew Johnson and of Bill Clinton, and see if we can sort of make sense of who the actors are and the ways in which the cast of characters matters. So I thought we'd
David,
today
we'd Sorry, I'm remote, so we're going to end up talking across each other even more than usual. Are you watching the trial?
I'm watching bits and pieces of the trial, but you know they don't start until 1 o'clock. U.S. Eastern Standard Time, and then goes late into the evening U.S. time, which puts it early into the morning here. And I'm interested in watching, but not that interested in watching.
Right.
Sure. How glued are you to the trial?
I'm not glued. I mean, I guess I'm following it. I mean, I'm here in Charlottesville, so I'm in the right time zone. And you know, it's a major time commitment, so I've got it on, I guess. And I there's very little to watch.
Yes.
In terms of, so I've got it on C-SPAN radio a lot of the times on my phone while I'm doing work. Although if I'm really trying to write something, it's a little bit distracting. And it's, you know, the early stage. I mean, I thought the second day, which was yesterday, of what Adam Schiff presenting the prosecution case, as it were, was really, really powerful and gripping. The day before when they were arguing over procedural matters, and we'll talk about this in the context of Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton in a minute, got to be pretty tedious because you knew what was going to happen. So anyway, we'll see.
I mean, I got the impression that many of the senators who aren't supposedly allowed to do very much during this whole procedure were also struggling to maintain focus yesterday. So we will see how this lasts as the trial progresses.
Well, I think I have some sympathy for them for that. I mean, I think if you told us as academics that we could have no devices and had to listen attentively.
Could drink milk or water.
Yes, four straight days. Days. That would be tough.
It's like exam boards. Exactly. Right. Right. All right. So I guess the first of that sort of cast of characters that we could look at is the Chief Justice. So in the Trump trial, this is the John Roberts, a Bush appointee. When we go back to, and I guess the way we're going to play this is, since I'm the 19th century guy, I'm going to be covering the Johnson trial. And Frank, since you were of maturity during the Clinton administration trial, actually, I guess I was too, but you have a better memory of it than I do. You'll be covering that one. So,
well, we're giving things up. I got Clinton because I'm older than you.
Exactly, right. with the Johnson trial, the Chief Justice, I think, is a very different kind of person in some ways, and in other ways not, than Roberts. The Chief Justice in Johnson's trial was Salmon P. Chase, who was different in as much as he was a career politician. One of the things, the ways of the court is different in the 19th century than it is, especially in the second half of the 20th century, is that most of the people who were on the court, Chief Justices, Associate Justices, were career politicians, and Chase would be in that category. So he was, from a fairly early part of his political life, a fairly strong anti-slavery activist. He starts off as a Whig, but then he helps to find the Liberty Party in Ohio. He later then helps to start the Free Soil Party. These are both anti-slavery parties, devoted to restricting the spread of slavery into the West. He's elected to the Senate in 1848. He opposes the Compromise of 1850 and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Later on, he helps found the Republican Party. He's the governor of Ohio. He's one of the guys who's in the running for the Republican nomination in 1860 that goes to Abraham Lincoln. And he gets named Secretary of the Treasury. He's Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury for basically his first term. And when Roger Taney dies he replaces Taney as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So he's interesting in as much as he's been in all three branches of government, right? So he had been in the Senate, he had been in the executive branch, and you know, during the trial, he's Chief Justice. Chase is a pretty serious kind of guy. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he thought going to the theater was frivolous, he didn't like reading fiction. You know, he was a fairly kind of stern, serious guy. And one of the questions that Chase was wrestling with, and I think we might see evidence of in this trial, is what exactly the role here is of the Chief Justice in the trial, right? If you look at the Constitution, Article 1, Section 3 says that when you have an impeachment of a president, the Chief Justice shall preside. But it's not entirely clear what that means. Because at the same time, the Senate gets to make their own rules about what they're doing in the Senate. And so there's a couple times where Chase makes rulings in the Johnson trial and gets overruled by the Senate, which is sort of a very interesting way of, you know, I guess, thinking about this as a trial. And after he gets overruled a couple times, he basically just stops being an active participant, really, in the procedures. What are things like with the Clinton impeachment?
Well, that's interesting, David. I mean, we'll get to the rules in a second, but I think that what we see, so William Rehnquist is the Chief Justice in 1999, in January of 1999, during the Clinton impeachment trial. And one of the issues that comes up at that trial is the fact that the Chief Justice presides, but unlike regular trials, criminal trials, for example, the Chief Justice's presiding officer isn't really a judge in the sense that he or she doesn't set the rules, but the Senate sets its own rules for the trial. So that came up, and we'll get to this in a few minutes, I think, under the with regard to the Clinton impeachment. So Rehnquist himself was a longtime member of the Supreme Court. He's a little bit different from Chase, I guess, in that he was primarily a jurist. Although he came out of conservative Republican politics, he was named to the court in 1972 by Richard Nixon. To some extent, Richard Nixon is the ghost who hovers over this discussion,
yeah.
Because although he was not impeached formally, he's the poster child for a lot of this. So Rehnquist was named to the court as an associate justice in 1972. He served as an associate justice until 1986, when he was named chief justice, and he served as chief justice from 1986 till 2005. He was quite long-serving. He's one of the longest-serving both chief justices and justices in the history of the court. He's very conservative. He's very conservative in terms of a lot of his constitutional interpretation, his interpretation of the law, but also in terms of the kind of his social and political views. However, in terms of his conduct of the trial, he does seem to have taken that responsibility seriously. There's one interesting thing that I learned in doing my research for this, which is that Rehnquist was a great fan of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Really? Yeah, well, yes, okay.
And Rehnquist is the one who added the four yellow stripes or gold stripes to the gown of the Chief Justice, and he did that as late – I didn't realize it was so late. He did that in 1995. But apparently he did so after seeing a production of Iolanthe, the Gilbert and Sullivan play, and he loved the way that the Lord Chancellor's costume looked in that. And so he took his inspiration from that, according to the internet. So whether this is true or not, I don't know. But the four gold stripes on the Chief Justice's robe are actually only 25 years old, and so they're relatively recent. And Rehnquist added those because of his enthusiasm for Gilbert and Sullivan.
Now, what did he do during the trial itself?
Well, basically, he read the questions, which is one of the roles of the Chief Justice. So the way that the impeachment managers are questioned by members of the Senate, they don't ask questions directly, so there's not meant to be as much grandstanding. So they submit things in writing in advance, and the Chief Justice reads out the questions, and then the impeachment managers for the president or in defense of the president or trying to convict the president answer those questions. So he did that, and but he like Chase, I don't think was terribly interventionist.
Well, I think Chase started off thinking, you know, because one of the things I guess it's different between these two trials is that, you know, when Johnson gets impeached, they really are sort of working from scratch and they don't have any precedent to work from. And, you know, the fact that the Constitution mentions this explicitly, that the Chief Justice is supposed to preside, at least in my way of reading, that seems to suggest that he's supposed to actually do something besides sit there and, you know, read things aloud, that he's supposed to have some kind of constitutional role. But in practice, as you know, in the Rehnquist, he just didn't seem to do that. And with Chase's example, like, he tried to and then got overruled.
Yeah, I think there's an important distinction or an important element by way of explanation in the Rehnquist case, which is the Senate Majority Leader, who then was Trent during the Clinton impeachment, was Trent Lott from Mississippi, and the Minority Leader was Tom Daschle from South Dakota, who's a Democrat. And on one hand, these guys were quite opposed ideologically. There's no question about that. However, there was a great – they had a good working relationship personally, and to some extent – and again, we'll get to this when we talk about the rules in a few minutes – really tried to coordinate things to make things run smoothly, so you didn't have the bun fight we saw the other day over procedural matters on day one with repeated votes that divided along partisan lines in the Clinton impeachment. And so I think there was more comity between – at least the Senate leadership in 1999, that ensured that things would go relatively smoothly, which meant, as a consequence, that Rehnquist didn't have to do a lot apart from preside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. Okay.
So there was less conflict than we're seeing. You know, the other night on day one, quite late in the evening, Justice Roberts had to kind of remind senators that they were, you know, members of what he called the world's greatest deliberative body. I think that's a trademark, but I think we can contest that. But more or less said, behave yourselves. Rehnquist never had to do that. As bad as as partisan as the Clinton impeachment was, it didn't degenerate and didn't do so in the run-up to it in the same way that we've seen with the Trump impeachment. And so, therefore, Rehnquist didn't have a lot to do.
Huh. Okay, that makes some sense. Okay. Because I'm wondering then what.
Can I ask you something about Chase?
Yes, sure.
So two things, or a couple of things, because I find him a fascinating character. You pronounced his name Salmon, not Salmon. Is that how he pronounced his name? This is a trivial matter, but.
I don't know exactly how he pronounced his name. I'll have to check on that.
Right. Okay. I didn't know whether you know, this was a thing that you knew. It's spelled like the fish and pronounced like the fish.
Yeah, I think it's. We'll have to check on the pronunciation of Chief Justice Chase's name.
Because this is of vital importance to our listeners.
I'm sure. Right.
But most people probably know him from. Many people know him. He plays a very prominent role in Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals.
Yes, he does.
For a while was a very popular book, as you know, probably to your exasperation. And so how persuasive do you find her portrayal of Chase?
I mean, I think she gets to the sort of details of his life, right? I mean, the problem with that book is it seems to suggest that having political rivals in your cabinet was something that Lincoln that was new, when in fact everybody in the 19th century did this, as you know. And Lincoln's cabinet didn't particularly work all that well together, so as a team it wasn't a great team. You know, and the extent to which they are rivals for the Republican nomination, but they are all politically more or less on the same, you know, page, or at least in the same book, even if they're not all singing from the same line. I mean, one of the things about Chase thinking about this is above and beyond, and this will be coming to play with some of the other characters as well. You know, Chase is the Chief Justice, but he is Also, you know, an active political figure, and one of the things that some people were thinking is he's actually considering running for president at some point. Obviously, he'd been considered in 1860. He's considering running in 1868, you know, and or afterwards. And so he's looking at this from the perspective of somebody who is not only defending the institution of the Supreme Court, but is also an active political participant in this story. And maybe, you know, the outcome of this trial may actually impact the his political future. So, which I think is very different than Roberts and Rehnquist, who are career judges and have never held elective office or, and position themselves in that respect.
No, and we're always told, for example, that Roberts is an institutionalist and really cares about the reputation of the court, and protecting the reputation of the court and seeing
And
it above
describes
all
himself
things.
as a as an umpire and calling balls and strikes rather than, yeah, that's the way he sort of
That's right.
positions himself.
That's
All
right. And I
right.
think that, sorry, and I think that I think Rehnquist saw himself in that role in 1999 as well.
All right, so let's look at the House managers, that is to say, the people who are working effectively as the prosecution.
Yes.
So, in Trump's case, we got a bunch of people. Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler seem to be among the people who are running, but they've got a half dozen other people who are part of the team. And in the past couple of days, we've heard from all of them at least a little bit. With Johnson's impeachment, we've got a similar wide cast of characters. There are, let me just count here, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven people on the team. Most of them are not people that our listeners would have heard of, with a couple of exceptions. One is Thaddeus Stevens, the Republican from Pennsylvania, one of the founders of the Republican Party. If you've seen the Lincoln movie, he is the one that's played by Tommy Lee Jones, I guess.
Yep, that's right.
Stevens is a very strong proponent of emancipation and had been for many years. He's a proponent of African American suffrage. He's even talked pretty extensively about property redistribution and ways of making emancipation meaningful. So he's probably of the team the most prominent and the most vocal critic of President Johnson. But he's in really bad health. Both during the impeachment in the House and during the Senate. At one point during the House part, during the impeachment itself, where he's trying to read a speech in the House and he can't finish the speech and he has to give it to another member of the House to finish reading the speech. He has to be carried into the Senate because he can't like physically walk there. You know, during the trial itself, he's speaks only a handful of times. During the closing arguments, he tries to participate there, and he can't finish his speech. Supposedly, he during most of the trial, he's there on the floor of the Senate, and he's trying to improve his health by consuming raw eggs and terrapin, and drinking lots of port and brandy. So I guess they had different rules about milk and water then in the 19th century. I don't know
Maybe
whether.
that's why maybe that's why there's a milk and water rule.
Yeah, I want my raw eggs, terrapin, port, and brandy. I think that would be for a more interesting trial. He dies not that long, actually, after the trial. So he's an important figure in terms of his political standing, but he doesn't actually play a very important role in the trial itself. The person who probably does play the biggest role in the trial is Benjamin Butler, who is a really interesting character. He was before the Civil War a Democrat from Massachusetts, and a one whose racial politics weren't really the best. He becomes a political general during the Civil War, so he's appointed not because of his military training or acumen, he had none, but because he you know, had these political connections and was able to bridge certain kinds of divides within the North. And he does a couple of very important things during the Civil War. He is the person who devises the contraband policy at Fortress Monroe in 1861 that becomes the legal framework for not returning runaway slaves during the Civil War, and that eventually leads in various fits and starts to emancipation. So he's critically important there. He's a very controversial general when he's running New Orleans after the Union invasion of New Orleans. And one of the things he's very famous for there is this General Order 28, in which he says that Confederate women in New Orleans who are disrespectful of Union soldiers will be treated like women plying their vocation, which was seen as an outrage by people on the Confederate home front. Later in the war, he is in charge of the Army of the James, which is one of the Union armies that has a large contingent of African-American, of USCT soldiers in it. So he's somebody whose racial politics sort of changes during the war itself. He's elected to Congress in 1866, and he's really sort of the guy who ends up doing most of the talking during the impeachment trial. But they got a bunch of other guys on there from different wings of the Republican Party. One of the things that they did in trying to pull this team together is trying to get together people who were, they're all Republicans at this point, although some of them had been Democrats earlier. People from different wings of the party, people who were seen as being radicals like Stevens, but also people who were seen as being more moderate. Parts of the party. Huge amount of experience, though. Many of them had served as governors. And so they brought all a huge amount of experience with them in the prosecution. What about in Clinton's case? Who are the prosecutors there?
There are 13 managers from the from the House Judiciary Committee who lead the prosecution of Bill Clinton. They are led by Henry Hyde of Illinois, who takes the lead. In fairness, I think it could be said that it's a mixed group. Some of them do quite well, some not. In terms of the Trump impeachment, I think the most important one on that group is Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. So Lindsey Graham takes a prominent role and actually did a pretty good job of presenting the case against Bill Clinton. And it's very interesting to me that last night, when Adam Schiff finished his very long presentation of the first part of the case against Donald Trump, Lindsey Graham congratulated him afterwards. Now, I don't think Lindsey Graham is going to vote for impeachment under any circumstances, but I think Lindsey Graham appreciated Adam Schiff's performance because he, too, 21 years ago, had to do the same thing. And so, there was a I think that was a very interesting and telling moment. So Lindsey Graham, he's not one of the more important of them, but he does play a role presenting the case. There are also some people. The impeachment in 1999 is interesting in a number of ways, and there are some crucial differences between it and the current Trump impeachment. One is, of course, that the House and Senate were dominated by the Republicans at the time and had Republican majorities, which it means that those two, the two chambers, worked in conjunction in preparing the case and presenting the case in a way that we haven't seen in the current situation, because, of course, the Democrats control the House and the Republicans control the Senate at the moment, and so there's an adversarial relationship. That being said, a number of the people among the House managers in 1999 were a little bit controversial, because in the late 90s, of course, in the mid-90s, we had the election of the kind of Gingrich dominated Republicans who took over the House and were far more conservative and more basically boisterous and rambunctious and confrontational than many traditional Republicans, especially in the Senate. And chief among these, for example, was a guy from Georgia, a congressman from Georgia named Bob Barr. And Barr played a prominent role in the Clinton impeachment, but probably not a very helpful role because of his, frankly, confrontational and aggressive manner in presenting the case. And this upset members, senators on both sides of the aisle. So even Republican senators who were critical of Clinton were also annoyed by Bob Barr, who they found annoying. The senators, yeah, the Senate is totally, the Senate is, as an institution, is up itself. And, senators think that they really do work in the world's greatest deliberative body. And they, particularly 20 years ago, placed a great deal of emphasis on basically proper behavior. And people like Barr actually were counterproductive. And I think the Democrats might have learned their lesson in the current impeachment, because the team seems to have been carefully picked by Nancy Pelosi to be experienced litigators.
Mm-hmm.
And the emphasis is on that background. Whereas I think the impeachment managers back in 1999 were a mix of experienced litigators, people, again, like Lindsey Graham, but also, and Henry Hyde, but also, if you will, filling out the team with political appointees who wanted their shot in the spotlight, like Bob Barr.
Sure.
So it was a bit of a mix in 99. The case was never, on one hand, because both the House and Senate were dominated by the Republicans, that was okay. On the other, the case wasn't terribly strong. And second, and crucially, Bill Clinton had a 70% approval rating when he was impeached in 1999. But Donald Trump's is at 40. We don't have data on Andrew Johnson, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't 70% for him.
No, it was not.
And so as a consequence of that, the Republican team, I guess the makeup of the team did matter, and I don't think it redounded to their benefit.
Yeah, I think with Johnson, it did. It mattered too. I mean, they tried to have this diverse team, or at least diverse within the sort of framework of Republican politics during Reconstruction. But given that the two sort of lead members of the team, Butler, who's doing most of the talking, and Stevens, who is sort of the symbolic head of the team, are really hated by a certain percentage of people in the Senate. That I think that played to their disadvantage. I don't know whether it switched any votes, but it didn't help them either. All right, so let's talk about that's the prosecution. Let's talk about the defense team. Trump's got a whole bunch of people on his defense team now. I guess the two main people are the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, is that his name? And his private attorney, Jay Sekulow. But he's also got these sort of like backbench of Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz and Pam Bondi and a whole bunch of other people. And I guess they now actually have just recently added a whole bunch of House Republicans who are also on the defense team doing something, including Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan and people. How impressed are you by Trump's team?
I'm not overly impressed. I would say I think Cipollone and Sekulow, and I'm just assessing their performance over the past couple of days. I have a little bit of sympathy for them in that they have a very difficult case to defend.
Yeah.
Secondly, because their client, is who he is. That basically they are performing, before the Senate, but and before the world. But to some extent, they are performing before an audience of one, and they have to satisfy President Trump and his expectations of what his defense should look like.
Hmm.
As regards the various celebrities, if you will, that have been attached to the defense team, that's not as crazy as it seems. I mean, in fact, I might have sent a mocking tweet or two the other day when Alan Dershowitz's name came up and Ken Starr. Ken Starr is the one that's perplexing, right? Because Ken Starr was the author of the Starr Report. To some extent, he was the driving force behind the Clinton impeachment. So it seems counterintuitive. It seems nonsensical to add him to your defense team, given the prominence he played in seeking to remove a president for actions that don't seem as serious as what President Trump is accused of. However, let me play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
I think adding Ken Starr might be an attempt to signal that, well, if Ken Starr doesn't think this is impeachable, it really is a nonsense. And it's, so I think adding Ken Starr might be a politically astute move, at least, and Ken Starr's very popular among the Clinton-hating wing of the Republican Party, which at this
point... Wait, there's another wing? Well, I thought that was the whole...
So Ken Starr's a bit of a folk hero there if he isn't in the broader culture, and it sends that signal. And to reference back to the Clinton impeachment, so Clinton had on his defense team a man named Charles Ruff. And Ruff played a fairly prominent role in the Clinton defense. Ruff, by contrast, had been one of the special prosecutors back in 1974 during the putative impeachment of Richard Nixon. And I think by adding Ruff to his team back in 99, Bill Clinton was trying to do something equivalent to what Donald Trump is doing in adding Ken Starr to his team. Mm-hmm. They're, in other words, saying, look, this guy supported impeaching the last guy, but he doesn't think there's a case here. And I think that you know, does send an important signal. Interestingly, with regard to the Clinton team, at the 11th hour, Bill Clinton tried to name members of the House Judiciary Committee, Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee, to his defense team in the same way that, as you just alluded to, President Trump has done adding, you know, Jim Jordan, et cetera, to his team. And this was blocked by a Democratic stalwart, Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia. Byrd, during his lifetime and during his very long Senate career, saw himself as the kind of, if you will, the keeper of the rules and the traditions of the Senate. And he thought this was inappropriate because those members who were in the minority on the Judiciary Committee would have had their chance to have their say and make their case during the Judiciary Committee's debate over the articles of impeachment, and that they shouldn't have a second bite of the cherry. So although these individuals were from the same party as Byrd, Byrd opposed them and quashed this attempt by Bill Clinton to do what Donald Trump has done. There is no Robert Byrd figure that I can see right now in the Senate, or at least on the Republican side, to kind of make that stand and seek to protect, if you will, the independence and authority of the Senate. What happened with the Johnson impeachment?
So Johnson actually got a, what looks to me to be a really strong team of people. So he's got you know, like Clinton did, and like Trump has, he has a whole team. There's a couple of important people. One is Henry Stanberry, who was at the time when the trial was about to start the U.S. Attorney General, as his lawyer, and he actually resigns from the post of Attorney General to preside or to help Johnson in the trial. So a very prominent lawyer. He's actually sick for most of the trial, so he doesn't do that much participation. Johnson actually tries to reappoint him as Attorney General after the trial, and the Senate rejects him. So I guess that none of that paid out well for him. Right. He's got William Everetts, who was a very prominent New York City lawyer, who was a Whig and actually became a kind of a conservative Republican. He's really the one of the people who's doing most of the a lot of the heavy lifting during the trial. He actually does get the Attorney General job in 1868 after Stanberry's resignation. One of the interesting people on his team is Benjamin Curtis, who is a former Supreme Court justice. He was actually, he's from Massachusetts. I think he's the only Whig to be on the Supreme Court. There's lots of justices who wear wigs, but only one who was a Whig. And Curtis was famous for being one of the two dissenters in the Dred Scott decision. And after Dred Scott, he resigns from the Supreme Court in protest, according to some versions of the account. In other versions, he resigned because the Supreme Court justices weren't getting paid a lot of money, and he'd make a lot more money as a private attorney. So, you know, he gives some stature to Johnson's team. He also has Thomas Nelson, who was a lawyer from Tennessee and a good friend of Johnson, on the team. And again, it's the idea of having a sort of a southerner on the team, I think, was important to Johnson. So it's a mixture of people, but a fairly prominent set of people, you know, including a former Supreme Court justice and attorney general. So he's got a good team. And obviously, you know, in all three, or at least in the two cases we've had thus far, the defense team was able to keep their client in office. What does the team look like for Bill Clinton? Who does he get?
The leader of his team is Cheryl Mills, who's the White House counsel. And she does a good job. And there's a pretty prominent list of excuse me, Washington lawyers. I mean, Bill Clinton had a number of legal problems, I think it's fair to say.
That is
his presidency.
Yes.
And therefore was very well connected in the Washington and New York legal communities. And of course, Hillary Clinton was a lawyer as well. And so his team is made up of prominent Democratic lawyers in the main. They are largely, with the exception of somebody like Ruff, they're largely independent. Well, not independent of politics, because most of them are sympathetic to Clinton, but they're not active politicians, and they hadn't played prominent public roles before necessarily. And the one distinction I think one thing that strikes me about the Clinton defense as opposed to the Trump defense, and I realize that the Trump defense is ongoing, it's just begun, but again, thinking about the past couple of days, is that the White House, so Sharon Ruff was White House counsel, but the Clinton administration sought to keep the impeachment trial separate from the other actions of the administration. Hmm. And so this was, if you will, hived off to Cheryl Mills and her team to look after, and Bill Clinton tried to remain separate from it. I read an interview recently over the past few days with Trent Lott, who was senator from Mississippi, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, the equivalent of Mitch McConnell today. And, you know, Lott talked about the fact that Clinton phoned him the week after, you know, he was acquitted by the Senate to say, okay, and he didn't mention the impeachment at all. He wanted to talk about legislation and, how, you know, what they were going to try to bring through the Senate next. That kind of separation and that kind of siloing just seems impossible with the Trump administration and his defense team. I mean, Jay Sekulow and Cipollone, you know, have been very prominent media figures for the past 2 or 3 years, and undoubtedly will continue to be so. You know, I don't think Cheryl Mills was on CNN to the same extent that Sekulow and Cipollone have been on Fox.
Yeah, and obviously, if you look at Ken Starr and Dershowitz and stuff, they can't stay off television if they tried.
That's right. I suppose it is amazing that Giuliani is not on the Trump team.
Well, it's because he might be indicted.
Of course.
Thinking about actually the role of the client in this is interesting because, as you mentioned, you know, Bill Clinton didn't talk about impeachment. He didn't do it. You know, he sort of had a firewall in the White House between the people who were dealing with impeachment and he and the sort of the rest of the cabinet and everybody else would be dealing with the business of the country, the way I think that's the way he put it. It was an open question, I think, with Johnson's trial about whether or not Johnson would show up there at the trial. There was actually one point in which people were expecting Johnson to show up on the first day of the trial and be there as a defendant, as the person on trial, as you were. And Johnson, like Trump, you know, in the lead up to the trial was, Johnson was a very bellicose kind of guy. He was attacking people in the media. He was attacking people, almost attacking people physically. He didn't do that, but he came close to, he thought about it. And on advice of his lawyers, he, for the duration of the trial, kept remarkably quiet for him. We've already seen with Trump, he's responding to things that are happening in the trial in a way that Bill Clinton clearly didn't. So we will see. But, you know, it is a possibility Trump could show up in the Senate, you know, physically. Weirder things have happened already in the past 3 years.
And he loves a show. I mean, you know, I think that possibility, yeah, I don't think it's likely, but it's much more conceivable that Trump would turn up than, say, Bill Clinton.
Yes. Yes. So we will see how that unfolds. So let's start to talk about the Senate itself, because I think, you know, that they are functioning as this court of impeachment. And I think it's worth pointing out in thinking about this, whether we want to think about them as a jury or not. There's, I guess, a debate about whether we should think of them as jurors. But the Senate in Johnson's trial is actually very, very different than the Senate we have today, or the Senate we have with the Clinton impeachment, in several important respects. The first is that in the 19th century, the senators are elected by state legislatures. So they are removed from the democratic process by an additional step compared to senators today, right? So one of the issues with the Senate today is what effect is this going to have on their reelection for those of them who are up for election soon in the next cycle or two. Whereas in the 19th century, the senators are less dependent on popular support than they are today. Second thing that's interesting with the Senate in 68 is that not all states had senators in 1968, because after the Civil War, not all states had been readmitted to the Union. So most southern states didn't have any senators representing them at Johnson's trial. So Tennessee did, because they had been readmitted to the Union, but basically the rest of the South did not.
Because, of course, one of the things that was at issue in Johnson's trial was Johnson's conduct of Reconstruction policy.
That was the issue, and obviously the sort of the aftermath of that's going to shape all kinds of things. There's some other ways, though, in which the issue of the Senate is going to be different in 68, and one of them actually has to do with who would become president were Johnson to be impeached. Because Johnson did not have a vice president. Johnson was Lincoln's vice president. Lincoln dies. Johnson becomes president. Johnson had not appointed a vice president. And under the rules at the time, the president pro tem of the Senate becomes president were the president to be removed from office without a vice president in this scenario. So if Johnson gets removed, Benjamin Wade, who was in the Senate, would have become president. And there was a dispute right at the beginning of the trial whether Wade could be an impartial juror in this trial, because he would benefit were Johnson to be removed. There are people who object. This is one of the places where the Chief Justice has to sort of come in. And Wade was a very controversial senator. He was definitely, you know, in the radical wing of the Republican Party. He believed not only in black suffrage and in trying to make freedom meaningful, he was also an advocate of women's suffrage, which at the time was a fairly radical position. So he's on that wing of the Republican Party. And Wade was able to sort of stay in the Senate and participate in the trial because he said, look, the state of Ohio deserves two representatives, and if I don't vote, then the state and the people of Ohio are being denied representation. So he's in the trial, you know, he's serving as part of this court of impeachment, even though he's clearly involved. Another person who's involved is Andrew Johnson's son-in-law, who's also in the Senate, Senator David Patterson from Tennessee. So who was married to Johnson's daughter. Right. So one of the things that's different about politics in the 19th, D.C. politics, is different in the 19th century than from the 20th century or from today, is really how small of a world this is. Right. There aren't that many people in the Senate. There aren't that many people in the House. They all know each other much better, I think, than people in Congress do today.
Well, they share boarding houses in many cases.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they literally live together.
Yes, they live together, they dine together. You know, there isn't a whole lot to do in D.C. They couldn't travel home to their districts, you know, on the weekends the way that congressmen do today. And there was much more intermixing between branches of government, between the House and the Senate, between the Congress and the executive branch, between the courts and the other two branches. And so I think there was a familiarity that the people were involved in the Senate trial for Johnson, they all sort of knew each other in a way that it wasn't true necessarily in the Clinton or in the Trump impeachments. How does the Senate in Clinton's impeachment factor into all this?
Well, I think the senators as jurors are interesting in the Clinton impeachment, not least because our friend Representative Barr raises the issue. He calls them jurors. Early on, and Tom Harkin, who's the senator from Iowa,
yeah,
objects and says, we are not jurors, and cites chapter and verse from the Constitution to demonstrate this, in part to say this isn't a criminal trial, and it doesn't have the same rules as a criminal trial. And Justice Rehnquist early on agrees with Harkin that although the senators sit in judgment of the president and consider these charges, they are not formally jurors. And I thought that's an interesting distinction, which in all the press coverage and in the way that the current impeachment is being presented and to some extent it's fine. The argument one keeps hearing is that the senators are jurors, but in the Clinton trial that wasn't. That distinction was made early on, saying, yeah, actually, these are not jurors in the criminal sense. In terms of the Senate itself, I think it's interesting that, I mentioned the kind of Gingrich revolution of the mid-90s and this kind of shift to the right of the Republican Party that was beginning, which to some extent reached its, manifesting itself in 2016 and subsequently. But that was just beginning. You know, Fox News was in its infancy at this point. The House Republican Caucus, I think, was much more conservative and much more what we now would call populist in its inclinations than the Senate was. I think the Senate was, did have that sort of aloofness even in the 90s that it no longer has. The current Senate Republican Caucus is very much integrated into the Republican Party Fox Media universe in a way that it wasn't, or not to the same extent, in the late 90s yet. And so a case in point is, on the very first morning of the Clinton impeachment, the Senate went into an informal meeting, all 100 senators, under the leadership of Senators Lawton Daschle, the Republican and Democratic leader respectively. They met for 2 hours in private session. It was informal. It wasn't part of the formal impeachment proceedings. So I suspect that Judge Rehnquist wasn't there. I don't know for sure. They met and agreed on the rules for the impeachment trial. And as a consequence of that, they voted 100-0 in favor of in agreeing on what the rules of the trial would be. In contrast to what we saw the other day on the first day of the Trump impeachment, when the senators from both sides basically spat it about the rules and had 11 procedural votes, which broke down on party lines. That didn't happen in 1999. So as partisan as the situation was in 1999, it wasn't as partisan as we're seeing today. Context matters. You mentioned senators who are vulnerable right now. I mean, there's an election in the offing later this year. Trump is up for re-election later this year. In 1999, Bill Clinton was in his second term. He would not be up for re-election. The election was still much further off in January of 1999 than it. We're only 10 months away from the election. They were over, a year and a half away. So the circumstances were different. And those vulnerable senators, like Susan Collins of Maine today, or Martha McSally, they didn't face the same kind of peril, I think. And we see this in the voting. We don't know how the Trump impeachment is going to play out, but in the voting on the articles against Bill Clinton, 10 Republican senators voted with the Democrats in opposing the first article of impeachment against Bill Clinton, which was about perjury. Excuse me. And on the second article, 5 Republican senators voted with the Democrats. And so in both cases, we had a significant number of Republican senators out of 50 crossing the line, or 55 rather, crossing the line to vote with the Democrats. It's very hard to imagine that happening. I don't know what's going to happen in the Trump impeachment, but I suspect that's not going to happen. So I think the Senate was a little bit more, it looked like the Senate today in the sense that we have a partisan division between Republicans and Democrats. But I think because of the institutional interest that a lot of senators had, regardless of their party, there was a desire to protect the Senate as an institution in 1999, and I don't think that exists today. I think the Senate is as partisan today as the House is, and much more partisan than it was back in 99.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, one of the things about during the Clinton impeachment is you got some people who were in the Senate then who had been in the Senate for forever.
Yeah, Robert Byrd.
Yeah, and some of these people who had been in one party and had switched parties as the parties had realigned, in the 60s and what have you. And so I think there's a, you know, there was a space in the Senate for liberal Republicans and a space for conservative Democrats, and you know, the kind of partisan hyper partisanship that we've got today, and sort of tribalism didn't exist then.
Yeah, there's been a partisan sorting now that, to some extent, is convenient because the parties really do stand for very different things. But to the extent that, combined with the kind of social things you were talking about, senators now go home at the weekend. They don't spend as much time together as they used to. They don't spend as much time together as they used to, and so there's just less conviviality between the two parties within the Senate, and there's less of a sense of protecting the Senate as an institution, more or less from the tawdry democratic, small d democratic tendencies of the House of Representatives.
Well, I think that the sort of the politics of the Senate mattered a huge amount also in Johnson's case, because in part because they knew if Johnson gets removed from office, then Benjamin Wade would take over. And, you know, Benjamin Wade was popular among many people in the Senate, but not everyone wanted that version of the Republican Party to be in the White House. You know, and they are looking forward to the next election, which is just, you know, that later that year. And so, you know, there's they're playing an interesting calculus about, okay, if Johnson doesn't get removed from office, then what happens? What happens for the rest of Johnson's term? What happens in the next election cycle? There are lots of sort of meetings and dinners that happen during the trial between people in the Senate and people in the executive branch, people who are in the military, people who are, you know, either in close contact or allied with the president, to sort of calculate what the right sort of political steps were to take. You know, and just thinking back to Tom Harkin's claim that they're not jurors, I think that's a, you know, seems to be at play really in all of these trials, right? Because jurors, you're supposed to be impartial, you're supposed to be go into a trial with an open mind. You're not supposed to know who the other jurors are before you go in, you know. You're not supposed to decide what the jurors don't get to decide what the rules are. The jurors aren't supposed to talk to the press between meetings that the court is holding, you know. And so there's, you know, elements of this where you know they're told to shut up and be quiet for the 8 hours a day, although they don't seem to be playing by the rules as well as even in day two as well as they're supposed to. But they behave and they have very different sort of, in some ways they're like other judges. They are a court of impeachment in which they are all judges with the power to make choices, and the Chief Justice is simply the head judge among them without a
That's
whole lot of
right.
power. So yeah, we will see how all of this unfolds over the next I guess it's going to be a couple weeks of opening statements, if you if I'm reading the calendar correctly.
Well, one of the things they decided the other night was to, and Mitch McConnell had to make concessions to his own caucus for this, was to spread the 24 hours of 20 of opening statements over 3 days rather than two. So each side will have 3 days to make their case before we, and then they're going to revisit the question of evidence and witnesses and so on. So one reason we haven't spoken too much today about the trial is not that much of the trial has happened yet, but I'm sure we'll probably be returning to this.
Yes, we undoubtedly this will be a topic that will produce many episodes of the podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will, I guess, table this for now, and we will see how this develops in the days and weeks to come, because I think it's going to be, as everything with the Trump administration, the history will be interesting preface, but will not be a talisman for forecasting what's going to happen, because I think almost anything could happen here, even with the Republican control of the Senate. Right. Time for last drops. What you got?
Yeah, I got a couple of things. On Saturday, well, the first thing I wanted to mention is something that a lot of people would be aware of, I think, is that earlier in the week, it's hard to keep track of the days, there was some controversy online in particular because the National Archives had released some images of the Women's March
Yeah, I think it was for a display for it's the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage amendment. So
that's right.
Yeah, the women's march from 2017.
That's right. So just 3 years ago, in January 2017, there was one of the largest demonstrations in American history. The women's march took place around the country, but including in Washington D.C.
And around the world.
And around the world, yes, that's right. But there were. As has become de rigueur in many protests now, there were lots of rather witty signs, and there were signs that were quite critical of President Trump being carried by many of the demonstrators during the Women's March, unsurprisingly. And the National Archives, in their exhibition on this, had blurred some of the images and the signs that were more critical of President Trump. There was an immediate backlash online, and excuse me. And this was important, not least because the National Archives is meant to be, just as its name implies, the kind of national repository of historic records. And you can't change the records because they upset the president, was the nature of the criticism, which was quite valid to my mind. What I found interesting was the National Archives almost immediately and quickly for a government organization issued an apology. And it was not one of those "I'm sorry if you were offended" apologies. They said, "We got it wrong. We're sorry." So mm-hmm. that was one good thing that came out of this. But the worrying thing was the kind of politicizing the archives of the United States, which is something I think nobody should want. So that was an event earlier this week. But I'm also I'm in the States right now, David, as you know, and I'm heading up to Washington on Saturday to attend the Scottish University's Burn Supper, it's an annual event. And Burn Suppers, of course, are an annual Scottish event held in January each year to celebrate the national poet Robert Burns. Parenthetical, and don't say this to anybody that who's going to be there. I'm not a huge fan of Burns's poetry, but that's a separate
I'm sure they don't listen.
I'll keep that to myself. however, the Burn Supper, a Burn Supper is a great event. It's a celebration of much of what is great and wonderful about Scotland. This Burn Supper is held in Washington every year, and it involves the Scottish government's representatives in the United States, as well as alumni and staff from the universities of Edinburgh, St. Andrews, and Glasgow. It's always a fun event, and I'm greatly looking. Burn Suppers have a long tradition. I'm going to say a few words of welcome. And there's a kind of long history of Burn Suppers, both in the United States, in Scotland, of course, but in the United States and around the world. So I'm looking forward to that. And if you are a listener and you're there, come up and say hello.
And I think this year it intersects with Chinese New Year. Are you going to do anything to commemorate this synergy of holidays?
I am not.
Okay. I've been trying to figure out how to get haggis into dumplings or something to be able to do both at the same time.
Haggis dumplings is a good idea. You could do that.
Okay. We will see whether my family will eat that for dinner on Saturday.
What's your last drop, David?
I think as most listeners know, last Monday was Martin Luther King Day, so most people in the United States had a 3-day holiday. But in Virginia, you had a 4-day holiday because Friday, the Friday before the King long weekend, is Lee Jackson Day in Virginia, which is a holiday of some antiquity. They've been celebrating it for many, many years. For a period of time, and this is my students are always amazed when I tell them this, Lee Jackson, who are, of course, celebrating the Confederate generals, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, both of whom are from Virginia. Lee Jackson Day was combined with the King holiday when the King holiday was introduced. And so there was a period from 1984 until 2000 in which Virginia had one holiday that was Lee Jackson King Day. Which many people were rightly offended by, and then they split it into these two separate holidays. Well, this week the state of Virginia announced that they are no longer that King Jackson or that Lee Jackson Day is no longer going to be a state holiday, and that they are going to make Election Day a state holiday, which I think is a good move on both parts. So, cheers to the end of Lee Jackson Day in Virginia.
Excellent. Well, as you know, David, I am in Virginia at the moment.
Did you two celebrate? Yeah, you get both days off?
well, I'm doing research, so
you get no days off.
You get no days off, but I'm not complaining because I enjoy doing research. Although Monday was not just Martin Luther King Day, Monday was also the day that 20 to 25,000 gun rights activists descended on the state capital of Richmond, which many people will have seen on the news, to oppose the measures being considered by the state legislature in Virginia, the House of Delegates, to restrict gun ownership. So the Democrats did very, very well in last November's elections in Virginia and now control both houses and the governorship of Virginia. And so they are instituting not terribly radical gun control legislation, but gun control legislation nonetheless. And 25,000 self-styled gun rights activists who are heavily armed.
Yeah, those were some scary pictures.
Almost entirely white members of the public turned out to protest this legislation, and it was slightly unpleasant and incongruous, of course, on Martin Luther King Day, particularly given the fact that Dr. King was assassinated by somebody using a gun. But Virginia and politics and holidays is a complicated business.
That to be sure, right?
Yeah.
Right. Until next week. Cheers, Frank.
All right, David. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.